When your baseball team does something that your football team couldn't do for several seasons in a row, win by two touchdowns. 14-0, the Toronto Blue Jays beat the San Diego Padres yesterday at Rogers Center. This is Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. She is Julia Kreutz. Julia, you have been covering this series for the Padres side of MLB.com. How do you spin a 14-0 blanking that had like 30 errors, official and unofficial?
Yeah, that got away in a hurry. It was funny. It was a normal game, right, for most of it.
And then,
just things just escalated very quickly. You're right in that, you know, it probably shouldn't have been that bad for the Padres. It's just the defense kind of collapsed. It's tough. It's a tough time for them right now. Mike Shield said after the game that he can see that guys are pressing a little bit. It is seeping into the other side of the ball, as we saw in those late innings.
Was he packing his office, by the way, as he was talking to you guys?
Not yet. It doesn't seem like things would happen that fast. But, yeah, just a weird one. And the weirdest part, Blake, like I said, is that it looked like a pitcher's duel again. For most of it, we weren't necessarily sure, again, what we were going to get with Kevin Gausman, with the way that things had gone. His last start against Tampa Bay did not go his way because the splitter was not working and it was moving in funky ways that were not what he was expecting. Well, he seems to have rediscovered something here, and I know that you have sort of the numbers and the stats to back it up here.
Yeah, so I was really impressed and excited by Kevin Gausman's splitter yesterday on Blue Jay Central before the game, and I teased it a little bit on this show. I broke down some of what's been going on with his splitter so far this year, and it's that he's gotten at least part of it. We'll simplify it here, but it's been getting a lot more left-to-right movement instead of up to down movement.
Right.
So that kind of, you know, you call it arm side run. If you're a righty, it kind of moves left to right away from a left-handed hitter or into a right-handed hitter. And you can throw a splitter effectively like that. But when you throw a splitter like that, it operates more like a secondary fastball instead of like an off-speed pitch. So Jeff Hoffman likes that his splitter does that. He wants to pound his splitter in the zone. It gets a ton of movement. He throws it 90. Yariel Rodriguez, he's cut back the splitter usage a little bit in his relief role. But when he's throwing that, he doesn't mind the left-to-right movement on it because he throws that hard and it's more like an extra fastball for him. Kevin Gausman, Bowden Francis, Chris Bassett, those guys want more depth on their splitter. They want that up-down movement, and they'll use the term carry. They want it to carry the zone a little bit more, so it looks like the fastball a little bit longer, and they kind of play off of each other directionally. And think about it. If you're trying to have a splitter play off of a fastball and the splitter starts moving left to right a little earlier and a little sharper, it's probably a little bit easier for a hitter. It's not an easy pitch to hit. The numbers on it were still pretty good, but it's maybe a little easier for a hitter to tell this is the splitter coming, not the fastball, because its movement profile is a little different. What we've seen so far this year is that more than at any point in his career, Gausman was getting that left to right horizontal movement at the expense of the depth, the up down movement. In fact, he was first in the entire league in how much his splitter was moving horizontally. And I asked him about it last week, and he kind of said, you know, that's not what he's looking for. He prefers the depth to his splitter. That's what he wants. I talked to Chris Bassett about it yesterday. He said the same kind of thing. Again, because both of those guys use theirs as more of an off-speed pitch rather than an extra fastball. So he comes out yesterday. He revealed after the game that he tweaked his finger positioning a little bit. And I love talking about splitters because it's such a finicky pitch. And even with more and more guys using splitters, it still only accounts for like 3.5% of pitches in baseball. It's still a really low usage pitch league-wide. So the guys who can throw it well are always tinkering with it, and the feel changes and the shape changes. So I find it fascinating to look at this stuff. Last night he comes out, he's got the little bit of a tweak on it. And so I was sitting in seats for this game. Mm-hmm. So you don't get the benefit of the TV broadcast, and I don't have Savant or Game Day open. And I actually went to the game with Chris Black, a producer, and you know, we're sitting there and it looks good. But when you're off center behind a left-handed batter in the seats, you don't really know. And then I dug in a little bit more this morning on it. And lo and behold, the best results he's had on his splitter this year, the least left to right movement he's had on it, the more up down movement, that kind of vertical depth splitter. It profiled a lot more like his 2022 splitter. 2021 was kind of when it was at his absolute peak in terms of vertical movement, but he's back. Yesterday it was back to looking like the 2022 version of it. And he got just ridiculous results on it. They swung and missed at 48% of the splitters. He actually threw 46 of them, which is a season high. He only threw 92 pitches. So you think about that. You've talked about on this show when he a sign for you when the splitter's not there is maybe he'll go to the slider a little bit more.
How many sliders did he throw yesterday?
Two. And one of them was in the first inning, and Luis Arraez took it for a double.
Yeah, it's that is fascinating. I want to – we'll get back to discussing Bassett a little bit more in depth – or, sorry, Kevin Gausman a little bit more in depth. But I do need to ask you first, when you're watching a game from the stands with someone like Chris Black – And I even joked a little bit pregame with you. I said, okay, go geek out, the two of you.
Jeff Blair said, go get your calculators out and watch the game.
What is that like? Are you guys just sitting having a beer and geeking out, or are you just watching the game?
No, it's more like why it was more. So this is the first time him and I have actually, we've watched games in the press box together before, but not in seats. No, it's much more, it was just like watch the game with a buddy. Like we had a beer or two, like statsy stuff comes up, but like the old meme about like, shut up, kid. I'm calculating win probability here. That is not a real thing. And again, like also you kind of, you know, when I'm watching a game in a press box and I'm covering the game, especially if I'm doing a Jays talk after the game or whatever, I'm looking at the MLB research tool and I'm looking at the measurements on the pitches and you know, exit velocities and things like that, because I'm going to need to talk about it quickly. When I'm watching a game live and have a beer in my hand, I'm just like, I don't care. It's like, Addison Barger, ball go boom. Like that's about as much as I need when I'm watching it live. And then I can research that stuff after. So, I mean, I still think it's probably like an intelligent conversation we're having. But we're not talking about like, and from that spot, there's no way to tell the depth Kevin Gausman's getting on his splitter. You could tell they're swinging and missing at it a lot.
Yeah.
But you don't really know, you know, is he locating super well? Is it deep? Are they just struggling with the left to right? So, yeah, you got to put the calculators away a little bit, Jeff Blair.
And listen, if there was ever a game for you to just enjoy, last night was the game.
Yeah.
Right? There was so much going on, and we'll get to the offense in a little bit here. But just to sort of close the loop on Kevin Gausman, we heard John Schneider post game basically say that this is who Kevin Gausman is. And we know that. We have seen this version of him more often than not. Struggled this year. He's talking about, you know, changing a little bit of the grip on that pitch, which I also think is pretty fascinating. Like you said, Blake, there's just so much that is going on with a pitch like the splitter, and it takes such a toll on the hand and on the fingers and everything. So for guys who throw it, you kind of need to be tweaking it constantly, and that means that sometimes it'll get away from you and you need to be a little bit patient and keep working on it until it gets back. For a guy like Gausman, that is his weapon. That is his pitch, and that's why it looks so odd when the splitter isn't on and when he's not getting it going. Well, he's getting it going now. He figured it out, and I think 6 of his 9 strikeouts yesterday came on the splitter. That shows a ton of confidence on the pitch. The Padres are pressing. They are not in a good place offensively right now. They were swinging and missing quite a bit.
26 innings without a run now?
That's absurd. And if you are Kevin Gausman, then yeah, this is your get right team. This is your get right start, in which you are, you know, just trying to implement those adjustments and see the results. That builds confidence. Not that Kevin Gausman really needs it. He's a pretty even keel guy, but it does build confidence in the fact that, okay, maybe you can put the slider aside a little bit, just focus on what has made you good throughout this career. But it's not just the strikeouts, right? It's also that even when the Padres were making contact with the pitch, they weren't getting anything going.
They didn't have a single piece of hard contact off of the splitter. 92 was the highest exit velocity, which is like fine, but it's not, you're never going to be like, oh damn, I deserved a hit off of that when it comes off 92. So yeah, a lot of chase outside of the zone, a lot of swing and miss on it inside and outside of the zone. No great contact. And then, 13 whiffs on the splitter, 19 whiffs overall, which was safely a season high for Gausman. And went back and looked at his quote after the Rays touched him up a little bit when he talked about searching for that splitter. I love this quote. In this game, if you're not getting better, you're getting worse.
Yeah.
So I have to get better. So I love that sentiment, love that quote. And it's, you mentioned Schneider's postgame comments. If he is back to that looking like that, and look, it's one start, but when it comes to the splitter, we know how good Kevin Gausman can get rolling when he has the feel for that pitch, when he has the depth for that pitch. Pretty big thing for
and
the
he kept the
Blue Jays.
In it until the bats sort of showed up. Nathan Lucas That was probably still the biggest swing of the ball game.
I was going to say, until the bats showed up and then until the Padres showed up.
There you go. But, yeah, you know, you kind of look at the way things were going. Very tight game. Nathan Lucas breaks that tie with a two-run homer. And then what happened from the stands, from your viewpoint? What did you see?
I mean, I saw what everyone else saw. I do want to touch on that fifth inning. So it's interesting. Yep. Randy Vasquez obviously came in with good overall numbers, but we talked yesterday about some of the underlying concerns. He actually didn't walk anyone yesterday. The Jays had to be, he kind of dared them to be aggressive by staying around the strike zone a little bit more and things like that. But when you, if you ever not understood second time through the order, third time through the order kind of stuff, last night with Vasquez was a great example because he was still getting results. But you go back and it's the second time guys saw him because he doesn't throw that hard. He throws six pitches, but he's around the zone a lot and they're not elite pitches. Guys started to get it a little bit more. You know, Anthony Santander had a single, fought to a full count or fought to a 2-2 count and was able to single one off. Addison Barger hit, I think, the furthest fly ball you can possibly hit without it leaving the ballpark. This is a reminder, the 400 on the wall is to the base of the wall, not the top of the wall. Because you might look and be like, how did he hit a 405-foot ball and it wasn't a home run? Because it was the tippy top of the wall. So you started to see that hard contact. Nathan Lucas then homers off him. That was just not a very good pitch. Sweeper kind of hung high and in to Nathan Lucas.
Credit to him, though. I will say, credit to him for jumping on that on the first pitch. That's not, you know, something
when
that
I say
is
someone hung something, that's never to take it away from the hitter. It's still I would imagine 92 on a tee is still really hard to hit out of the ballpark. You get the credit still.
It's just, you know, we have seen more important quote unquote bats in this lineup let a lot of those very good first pitches go and just stare. Nathan Lucas was ready for it and clearly he had a plan of attack there. So I think that's more what I mean when I say credit to him, because there have been so many frustrating moments early in at bats for this ball club in which there's your pitch to hit. There is your one pitch to hit of the at bat, but it came on an 0-0 count, and so he didn't do anything with it. That is not what we saw from Nathan Lucas.
Also
yesterday.
A huge credit to Nathan Lucas taking advantage of your opportunities. I don't think at the start of the season he would have expected to be playing this much. Obviously, Varsho was hurt, and Anthony Santander has been in the lineup and things like that, but he's already at a career high for plate appearances, and it's May 22nd. And, I get that he's, you know, almost 31, so he's not prospect-aged, and maybe someone wants to look at Yonatan Class A or something like that. But Lucas has an 809 OPS. He had an 818 in a small part-time role last year. He's always had really strong AAA numbers. And even if he's just going to be strong side of a platoon right now while they wait for Santander to get fully healthy and they figure out the right rotation of guys and things like that, huge credit to taking advantage of the opportunity when it presents itself. 814 OPS against righties so far. So good for Nathan Lucas.
Four home runs. How many did he have last year? He had one, I think.
Yeah.
And it was pretty much the same number of at-bats. So definitely a guy who is benefiting from this time in the majors.
And as it turns out, that would have been enough. But it would have been higher stress for the Blue Jays the rest of the way to play with only a two-run lead. Yeah. So then the seventh inning comes along. I'm going to walk everyone through exactly all the Padres' mistakes here. You ready?
Yeah, please do, because at that point, it's all a blur. Those last few innings, literally, I couldn't tell
you.
My
notepad is this long for this in the eighth inning. So Addison Barger singles. Then Ernie Clement reaches on an obvious Manny Machado error, kind of goalie, glove hands it, doesn't come up with it. So the Jays have runners on first and second, nobody out, with a two-run lead. And they decide to sacrifice bunt.
Sure.
We've talked about this. One of the rare situations where I don't mind it that much.
Yep.
You know, you're about to roll the lineup over. So you're not bunting with Miles Straw on deck. You're bunting with Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. coming up. You're into their bullpen. You're trying to turn a two-run lead into a three or four-run lead. So you go to bunt.
Plus, you know that things are not going well for these guys. You know, you can see that they're pressing. And so why not, you know, just add a little bit more pressure in that situation?
So 100%. I don't mind it. I probably would have taken the bunt off when they got to two strikes. The Blue Jays did not. Nathan Lucas threw it down anyway. And then Manny Machado made another error. So the Blue Jays have the bases loaded. And then Bo Bichette hits into what should have been a double play. But Jake Cronenworth at second, it appears when he picks up the ball, it looks to me like he was unsure if he should go home
yep.
and get the lead runner or turn and go for two. So he bobbles it and they only get the one out. That is not an error because you got one out, and by the rule book, you can't assume a double play is going to happen.
Do you know what? I did not know that rule. That's the beauty of baseball, isn't it? There's always something new
to
learn.
Some rule.
And Blake Murphy is usually the guy who will teach you.
So we're at two errors and one misplay that probably could have been called an error if yep. the rule book were a little bit different. Then Vlad singles. They make a pitching change. Then George Springer singles. This is the one where Manny Machado goes deep behind third base. Unbelievable play.
Yeah,
for him to come up with that ball and make a very, very tough throw. And Machado gets, so Springer gets credited with a single. Machado gets credited with a throwing error because guys advanced after the throw. To me, this one is all Luis Arraez.
Okay.
I understand he is a short first baseman,
yeah.
but he is also a bad first baseman. He doesn't do a good job. Like he could have come off the base, or he probably should have been able to reach it generally. But once Springer is going to be safe and it's that close, you've got a responsibility to come off the bag and save the throw. I also just think, having watched it back, he could have made the play probably. And maybe I'm picking on Arraez. He did have two hits in this game. But there was also another play where Elias Diaz, behind the plate, backpicked the first base.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure Diaz is still crouched behind the plate right now. And I'm sorry, this is an audio medium, but I'm going to try to explain what happened. So Diaz backpicks the first base, and Arraez is out of position for the backpick, and he's like a little in front of first base when he picks up the ball. That's one thing. But then he still could have made the out, but he turned the wrong way to get back to first base. And I forget who was the base runner at this point, but basically they're like swimming to get back to first base, and Arraez can't find him. And Diaz stayed in his like low lunge warrior two crouch that he had thrown the ball in. And he just stayed there looking down at first base. The ball was already back to the pitcher. And Diaz is still just down there in his lunge.
Floored, literally.
So all of that is going on. And then Jonathan Clase pinch hits for Anthony Santander. So all of us are immediately like, uh-oh, like shoulder or the hip tweaked, and we'll circle back to that.
Yep.
But then this one is no base running here. Clase just hammers a two-run double to center field. He also almost catches Alejandro Kirk coming around second base. Like, Clase is looking three off the bat on this one and looks up, and he's going to catch Kirk. So big inning there. Five runs, three official errors, but probably closer to five misplays there. And then, by the way, they ran it back and did more of that in the eighth.
Yeah, that was, you don't often, I don't think we've seen a position player pitch against the Blue Jays like that in years. It's been...
How'd you enjoy the 51-mile-an-hour ephus
that Tyler Wade was throwing? I kind of love it. It's always an awkward situation, I guess, to see a guy like Addison Barger just put a good swing on something like that for a double. But yeah, obviously a sign of good things. Blue Jays also sort of saving the bullpen a little bit. Jose Urania went the rest of the way after Kevin Gausman left the game with seven scoreless there.
Oh,
good things all around. That's what happens when you score a bunch of runs.
Yes, good things all around. And it gives you an opportunity. So before Tyler Wade came in, I should have mentioned this, in the eighth, so after a hit batter and Vlad hitting into what should have been a double play that ends up with everyone safe because Jose Iglesias makes another error.
Yet another one.
Dalton Varsho hit a grand slam. And John Schneider pointed this out after the game, and I went back and watched. He took so long around the bases before he'd let himself enjoy it because he had a couple of really bad at-bats earlier in the game. It took him a minute to let himself appreciate that he hit a grand slam. It takes an 85-mile. Alex Jacob with that weird, funky delivery. 85 is not enough against Dalton Varsho when he's doing an angry swing.
A lot of 85s.
Yeah.
It was, that was
very Adam Simber-ish, the delivery and the velocity and
100%.
Things like that.
Yeah, didn't work. But, and listen, Dalton Varsho is going to have some bad at-bats in there because that is, unfortunately, also part of his game. He's going to swing and miss, and sometimes that is not going to work. He's going to guess wrong and all of that. But that was a good swing, and it was also a swing that speaks to the things that Dalton Varsho is working on right now, and that is not pulling everything, and that is using the whole field a little bit more, staying back a little bit to make sure that you know, you have your pitch. That was straightaway center field. It was a very, very good hit and another step forward in what Varsho is trying to do. Easy to do against an 85-mile-an-hour fastball, for sure, or easier to do.
I couldn't do it, but
you know, I could do it on my new PS5.
In the show, and hits it to the deepest part of the ballpark. So a lot of fun there. That's a long way to get to 14 runs. Mistakes that the Padres hand you. But one thing we've seen the Blue Jays not do so far this year is take advantage in spots like that. This was also only their fifth time this year winning a game by more than 3 runs. Only the Rockies have fewer, we'll call them comfortable victories. So helps your run differential. Not that that really matters.
They padded a lot of stats last night.
They sure did. And then, as you pointed out, the bullpen off day Monday, little Yariel and Hoffman used Tuesday, but in quick innings with a 3-run lead, so not the super high stress ones. And then nobody but Urena used yesterday. You're in really great spot pitching wise to try to sweep this series today. Caveat.
Yes, there we go.
Caveat the first. The Blue Jays, and this is from Avery of Gate 14, are now 7-2 when they have a chance to get back to 500. Mm-hmm. Per Jonah Bierenbaum of The Score, they are 2-7 when they have a chance to get over 500.
It's so weird. There's something going on.
They have been asymptotic to one game over 500 so far. We'll see if they can do it today. Caveat the second.
Yes, caveat junior.
Not the best lineup the Blue Jays could roll out there. Because it's a day game after a night game, because it's part of a 13-game and 13-day stretch, this is an Alejandro Kirk down day, this is a scheduled George Springer down day, and Anthony Santander is not in the lineup. He left the game yesterday with left hip discomfort. John Schneider said they'd see how it feels today. Not a big surprise that he's not in there today, given what Schneider described as awkward. Mm-hmm. So we'll continue to monitor that one. I do wonder, with the shoulder thing happening, with the hip thing happening,
give him an IL
with the struggles, I wonder if it's coming.
You have to.
At some point.
It's not like he's getting better. It's flaring up mid-game. So why not give him? And it's not like he's producing at a clip where you can't afford to be without him for these games. And so why not just give him a chance to actually heal and then restart?
And the why not is that John Schneider got asked about this post-game, and they think he's starting to turn the corner a little bit with the swing. And they don't want to risk sitting him down too long if they don't have to. Obviously, you could do a rehab stint and things like that.
Tough gamble.
We'll see if they bring a taxi squad guy on the road with them. They leave today. So it'll be interesting to take a look at the Buffalo Bisons lineup later and see who is and is not in there. Joey Loperfido has probably hit the best of the guys down there for the entire season. But that's another left-handed hitting outfielder. Maybe you see that as a little bit redundant. Alan Roden has been great since he went down. They are facing a string of righties in Tampa, so maybe the lefty thing doesn't matter as much, given that Roden's raked since he went down there. Aralvis, I don't think, is in the conversation. He just hasn't been playing well enough and doesn't really have a position. Will Wagner's on the IL. And then the really interesting one is, if you look at Davis Schneider's overall batting line since he went down, it's not that great. He was a player of the week last week, though, and has been hitting a little bit more, still striking out, but the hits have started to come a little bit. And maybe it would give them a righty option off the bench that they need a little bit with if you take Santander out of the lineup. Obviously, Santander, a switch hitter, but a couple ways you could go with that if you do need an extra guy.
Yeah, that's interesting. We haven't spoken about Davis Schneider in a while. I think it's been at least 3 weeks since we talked about him. I forget when exactly he was sent down, but you know, pretty much immediately after he got sent down, things were not working very well here. And then he started hitting a little bit. And then that is when we started hearing about, you know, bring back Davis Schneider. I was very against
that. Have you heard about that?
I
guess you're doing more post games than
I have. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But, you know, I wasn't really, I didn't subscribe to that at first. But we are at a point now where, it might be time to give him another chance here to see what he can do. And to see if there is, you know, real progress to be had at the major league level. It didn't show up at first, but sometimes all you need is a reset. Right?
Yeah, and it didn't get off to a great start, but over his last 13 at AAA, 4 homers, 3 stolen bases, hitting .270, and still striking out like once a game, but that's always going to be a part of David Schneider's profile, I think. So we'll see how that goes if, in fact, they need a roster move or a taxi squad guy when they hit the road today. That game's at 1 o'clock today, by the way. It's not the usual 3 o'clock start. It's a 1 o'clock start. So we'll continue to get you set up for that. It's Bowden Francis against Stephen Kolek. On the Padres side, Kolek, not a lot of track record, but a good start to his season with a 2.33 ERA. We'll get you set up for that more in the second half of the show. We're also about to talk to Doug Glanville of Sunday Night Baseball, of course, a 9-year MLB veteran as well. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy, Julia Kreutz with you. We will talk to Doug Glanville in a couple minutes here. We'll go around baseball. Hope you like Mets. Because this past Sunday on Sunday Night Baseball was Mets-Yankees. This coming Sunday, it's Mets-Dodgers. Heavyweight fights only on Sunday Night Baseball. Soto versus Judge, Soto versus Ohtani, Soto versus New York Mets
fans. Yeah, it's I can't wait to talk about that, actually. Did you watch those at-bats against Garrett Crochet yesterday? I guess you were at the game.
Yeah, I was so at the game. And then when I got home, it was all Pacers-Knicks.
Right, of course it was. Absolutely. But yeah, it's just... That was weird, man. Like, you know, you're Juan Soto, you're facing Garrett Crochet, he's throwing in the zone, and Soto just refused to swing. If Juan Soto's name is trending on Twitter these days, you immediately just get a little bit on alert, I'll put it like that, and there was good reason for that. Kind of a weird one. The Mets ended up beating the Red Sox last night, and that series has been... very controversial too. Walker Buehler getting
yeah,
tossed in the
that
first
was
game.
That's a bad one. Like I went back and watched that part of it from Tuesday's game.
Yeah,
that was umpire escalation.
It was
like,
huh?
I'm always gonna side against authority figures and cops and stuff like that, but like that one particularly was umpire escalation.
I thought that
could have been handled much better.
It's tough, you know, and obviously as a starter, that was a strike through and through. There's nothing that you can say or do.
I mean, yeah, whatever about the actual call, but the argument, like the umpire taking things to the next level, is
literally just escalating the situation for sure. So you know, pretty contentious series. The Mets are kind of all over the place right now. I don't really know what to make of the Phillies. Are actually in first place in that division.
Yeah, they won't stop losing. I mean, winning, rather.
Yeah, six in a row, I think it is, for the Phillies.
Yeah.
So a lot to look out for in that National League East.
Yeah, and we'll talk about it with Doug when we get him on the line here in just a minute. While we wait for that, here's the Jays lineup for today, because, again, it's a 1 o'clock start. Behind Bowden Francis, Bo Bichette, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Dalton Varsho at the top. That's about what you've come to expect. It gets a little weird after this because Kirk Springer and Santander are all down. So 4-9 goes. Addison Barger at third, Ernie Clement at second, Nathan Lucas in right, Jonathan Clase in left, Miles Straw in center, and Tyler Heineman behind the plate. So it is not the Blue Jays A lineup with three regulars down. However, we'll see if they can keep the momentum rolling. They've gotten contributions from guys further down the order at other times this year, and this is why you have 13 guys on a roster. Let's take it back to that New York conversation. We're joined now by Sunday Night Baseball ESPN analyst and co-host of the Starkville podcast, Doug Glanville. Doug, what's up, man? Thank you for doing this.
All right. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
You guys had Mets-Yankees this past Sunday. You got Mets-Dodgers this coming Sunday. The Mets are in a big one with the Red Sox right now. This is a lot of Mets for you. What do you make of where they are right now? Obviously, the Juan Soto thing is a little uncomfortable, at least right now.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I was following them almost all last season at the end. So I did the last season series against the Brewers, the Mets Brewers. Then I covered their playoff run all the way to the end. So I remember our Carlos Mendoza was like, we got to get you a locker, man. I see a team that has figured a lot of things out. And that is that they're able to piece together success and wins, not necessarily relying on like the one bat, right? The star. They've had pitchers that last year, Sean Manaea, Quintana, you know, guys that weren't necessarily going to be Cy Young Award winners, just pitched consistently well. And they figured out how to take guys like Clay Holmes and convert them. They can see ways to get pitching without the sort of traditional, oh, let's just sign the big free agent and just like power our way through. So that's allowed them to be pretty good on the run prevention side. And then you look at their offense with, you know, Alonso having a better year and just getting Soto, whether he's playing at the level, not quite, but he has a presence and his at bats still are bats that you pay attention to. So I think they're a team that has actually an upside from where they are now.
Yeah, Doug, we were talking just before you joined exactly about that. Juan Soto's at bats. I think that yesterday maybe we paid attention, especially to the first two, for not the best of reasons, right? Yeah. Him and Garrett Crochet, and he just didn't swing. It was just three pitches in the zone. What are you seeing from Juan Soto, just, you know, in terms of the fit with the Mets and where he is offensively right now? It seems to be a little bit weird at the moment.
Yeah, well, the example I point to is Freddie Freeman, right? Freddie Freeman was extremely upset the entire first year he was with the Dodgers, to the point where Clayton Kershaw was like, okay, dude, like, what's up? So what I underscore in that is there is an adjustment period, like, and players handle it differently. And yes, they threw all kinds of money and he negotiated all these things. But at the same time, just your humanity, you're trying to figure out a new environment. You may have chosen it, but it's still a challenge. And yeah, maybe it's been a lot harder dealing with the Yankee backdrop of this and the frustration of the Yankee fans and just the, you know, how they're coming at him, going into New York and Yankee Stadium and playing that series. So there's that element. Then there's the Juan Soto when he's not right aspect. You know, Juan Soto can get a little bit sort of late and, you know, he sees the ball, right? He lets it get incredibly deep and that's part of his strength. But the weakness in that is like, now you're kind of late. Mm-hmm. And if you're just a little bit late with him, he's fouling balls off to left field. He's, you know, behind the ball. He's just under the ball and he gets those kind of arcing fly balls to left field. And so that's Juan Soto when he's not quite right. And look, last season he was pretty much right most of the year. But this year, it's not there. But the Mets have found ways to kind of, you know, work around him not being the best version. And that says a lot for the Mets because they're still finding ways to win ball games.
Yeah, and Juan Soto's, you know, bad start is still an 800 OPS. It's interesting you mentioned that about being a little bit late. And we can look at the bat speed and things like that on Baseball Savant or StatCast. And the bat speed's down. It's interesting to see. And I'm sure he can. It's Juan Soto. I'm going to bet that he's going to find it back. But for right now, it looks like he's off just a little bit, as you laid out there. You mentioned the Mets finding ways around it. They've done that offensively until the last little bit. They've also done it with some really good pitching. And if things stay on turn the way we expect, you're going to see Kodai Senga on Sunday night against the Dodgers. Get this for having a high bar. The start against the Red Sox this week was his worst of the season, and it was still a quality start. It's the first time he's allowed three runs in a start all season. He'll come into that one with a 1.43 ERA. How much are you looking forward to getting a close eye on Kodai Senga and the ghost fork there?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it because I see someone that's, you know, evolved so quickly. You know, of course, he had his dominant history before he got to the MLB, but he's able to, you know, kind of combine that and use the split, the fork, really in the ways to get the chase out of the zone and then complement it with some other really good pitches. I like how he's complementing. That is really the key because a guy that just has one pitch or one pitch he could command, hitters start to eliminate the other ones. They start, you know, not worrying about the challenge of like, okay, I can just lay off this one. And so when he's able to get it near the zone or tease hitters out of the zone, that's when he's nasty. And if you look at someone like, say, Yamamoto with the Dodgers, right? He said, okay, he's kind of figured out that I can keep on this plane at the bottom of the zone and drop it out of the zone. And now I'd say Senga's fork is a little bit different, sort of bigger, but it's the same idea of being able to say, all right, I've made the adjustments. I've seen this league now, you know, which is a huge change. And giving all these quality starts to the Mets, he puts himself in a position to be that true ace that they need, that they can rely on every fifth day.
So it's Senga for the Mets, Landon Knack, I believe.
Yeah, I was
Sunday.
Hoping that they'd use the off day today to juggle it a little bit. Maybe we'd get Yamamoto, but they put the probables up this morning. It's Landon Knack on the Dodgers side right now. No disrespect to Landon Knack.
Yeah, but it would have been a cool one to see Yamamoto there. But you know. There's been so much to talk about with the Dodgers on the pitching side, Doug, and not necessarily for the best reasons, a ton of injuries, but they're they're hanging in there. They've been able to, you know, withstand the rotation challenges and the pitching injuries. What are you seeing from the Dodgers in that sense that, you know, that's allowed them to hang in there?
Well, I'll tell you, it's the depth and the resources. I mean, that's their big factor. And, you know, I have to steal this from David Cone, because we did the Dodgers the first week or you know, one of the first Sundays after we had seen them against the Tigers opening day. And he asked the question of Dave Roberts, like, well, who's your 6 through 10? You know, because I know your rotation right now. And then when he kind of goes through who could be 6 through 10, it was like, wait a minute, that's an all-star team. So, you know, they have so much depth, but they're all hurt, you know. And so that is the question mark. It's like, can they outrun these injuries? You know, where you outrun it, it's like, all right, guys will eventually come back. That's part of it. Or you're just going to make the moves you need to make, like Jack Flaherty or something, and make those changes at the trade deadline. They're clearly all in, and they're just going to spend the money or get use the resources in either scenario. But my concern for the Dodgers is that the teams in their division are all better. Mm-hmm. So you don't have the margin to be like, well, you know, let me figure it out with like one starter out of five, while the Padres, the, you know, the D-backs and everybody's just right on their heels. And so that's what the risk is for the Dodgers. Like, they still have to be on a sprint, and they don't have the luxury of just like, yeah, let's take 3 weeks off. So in some ways that's fun, because we've seen them run away with divisions where they're like, you know, all these 20 games up, and it's like, oh, let's put Mookie Betts at catcher. Let's just see what happens. Because they're just like, let's just do whatever. But now, it's a lot tighter.
Yeah, 14 pitchers on the IL right now, and that's it. The other thing you can do is hit a lot, and that's where Andy Páez looking like a guy, Teoscar Hernandez coming back from the IL. Those are big things there. Want to go off of Sunday Night Baseball here, Doug. So in addition to that, you also co-host Starkville with Jason Stark, and you guys had an awesome chat with CC Sabathia in the latest episode. He's going to go into the Hall of Fame, and you know, people should go listen to that. But I'm curious as to how meaningful a conversation that was to you in general, and for you to see a Black American pitcher, one of the so-called 15 Black aces to have won 20 games in baseball, to be going in.
Powerful. It was really powerful. And it's crazy enough, I actually faced CC Sabathia a long time ago. And I'm sitting there going, like, I'm like retired and he's still playing like 10 years later. I'm like, this guy's still pitching? So I was just impressed with how he was so adaptable, you know, whether it's going to Milwaukee, coming back and going into New York, all the different environments he was able to thrive in. The fact that when he wasn't throwing 97, 98, he started to go back to his original pitching philosophy. I was amazed, and I wanted to like, wait a minute, is this possible? How he said he didn't shake off any of his catchers. Like, he just didn't shake his catchers off. He, even though he had a plan, he had that much confidence and trust and just kind of rolled with it. So, you know, that was amazing to me. You're talking about one of the great pitchers, you know, clearly of all time as a Hall of Famer. And he's saying that I didn't have to run the game. I just prepared with my catcher, and then I just trusted his instincts and his adjustments in game. So I thought it was, you know, really powerful to listen to, you know, how he was able to do this. And he, you know, he talked about how raw he was when he first started, and just, you know, through anytime he threw a slider, he dropped down. He just, that was it. I was like, you think you could figure out when his slider's coming? I wonder. So, you know, but he just continued to evolve and just a great teammate. Like, everybody loved him as a teammate and just everywhere he went. And that's a testimony to like how he prioritized being more than just a star of one. He really felt like this is like a constellation of greatness. And if I approach it that way, we're going to have a lot of success. And he certainly did.
On top of which, the other thing that stands out to me about Sabathia is the longevity, like 3,600 career innings. We might not see, like, someone who's coming along today is not getting to 3,600 innings. So. He kind of him and Verlander and Greinke, I guess, kind of the last workhorse types as well. So deep appreciation for how long he was able to do that for.
Absolutely. I do think you're seeing, like, he represents that end of an era, mm-hmm. and you're transitioning, and 200 innings, just, you know, it's just really hard to get nowadays. So that is what also makes him special, just to know that he carried it into a new generation, and he kind of like, you know, goes, you know, sails over the horizon, knowing that there's not really a whole lot of people behind him that does or did what he did.
These conversations, Doug, to me are so incredibly powerful because you get to see a little bit more of the person, a little bit more of, you know, maybe an inside look that's off the field. You had a good one with Jim Leland as well recently, but and that's something that you do, right? And that's important to you. I know that you're also a writer. It kind of surprised me that your book was actually published in 2010. I thought it was a little bit more recent than that, but, you know, I guess and it's called The Game From Where I Stand. It's available everywhere. And I'm just wondering where the writing part of you comes from and how important is it to you to be able to share these experiences that are not on-field experiences?
Well, it's extremely important. And I kind of make the case it's even more so today because to be able to sit down and try to be patient with the written word is hard nowadays, right? It's everything's so quick and you want to, you know, be pithy and get it in a top 10 list. And, you know, and it's like the patience to sit down. But I think the sitting down, not only just trying to encourage an audience to say, take the time, but also for me, right? It's just like, I want to digest my analysis a little bit and not just be knee jerk and, you know, accuse and jump at stuff and then be like, oh, wait a minute. I don't know what I was talking about there. I wanted to really like take the time, and the writing allows me to get the perspective because I do the deep dive. I research. When I did the piece on Pete Rose recently, I read the entire Dowd report all over again. I said, let me just read this again. You know, so that's important. But now personally, writing became really close to me with my father because my dad, he passed away on the last game of the season in 2002, the day I got my 1,000th hit of my career. So it was really like overwhelming to say the least. And he'd been sick for 3 years. So I think in that process, he loved poetry. And I think a nod to his writing and also to my mom's sort of social activism to try to bring change about in her community sort of, you know, sort of combined around my writing. And I just wanted to do that slow work. So in some ways it's a little bit therapeutic. You know, my father has been gone over 20 years and I think it's like a connection to him. But it's also a nod to like how, you can inspire and change and in some ways, you know, contextualize things that are getting these very quick knee-jerk reactions to a lot of times that you just want to slow down. And so I love it. And I like to cover just things that are seemingly kind of random. Like I never had an alias on the road, for example. A lot of players get alias, right? Like, you know, like why is that? You know, it's just, it's different than like, oh, you know, breaking news or, you know, this is a hot story right now, which I know of course has a lot of value, but it's also, you know, taking the deep dive and stepping back a little bit and not always have to feel first. So I love it. It's really important to me and I appreciate it. You know, it's gone well so far. And just, you know, I have another piece coming up about the bulletin board that was over my bed growing up. And there was a picture. I pinned everything on there over the years. And it's like this baseball world. And now, and like Bob Boone, Aaron Boone's dad was in the lower corner and I sent him the picture and he's like, I can't find it. I said, where's your Easter egg, man? Go find it. So it's kind of like an Easter egg hunt. So having fun.
That's great. And the book is The Game From Where I Stand. And the Substack is dougglanville.substack.com. It's called Welcome to Glanville. And like you laid out there, great mix of stuff. I see the plushie in the background of your shot there that you wrote about. A great tribute to our pal Sarah Langs of MLB.com on the stats side. So a lot of great stuff there. Doug, before we let you go here, I wanted to ask about, and this isn't exactly the trivia stuff, it's more of a hypothetical trivia, but you had some wheels. You stole 20, 30 bases a lot of time. I believe you led the league in infield hits a couple times. If you came around now with these slightly tweaked rules and base running's back up and it's a little, you know, it's a little cooler, teams are a little more willing to do it, how many bags are you taking now?
You know, I don't know because they're adjusting pretty quickly right now. You know, it's like the disengagements would have been a dream though. I mean, wait a minute, you're gonna what? Two times? That's it? Because they used to wear you out, like just throw over, lefties hanging their leg. So I think that would have been a big factor. What's really different to me is in many things, but the way the catchers can scoop balls in the dirt now, like that is so mind blowing to me because they used to block it and the ball would roll away and you just take second. And now they just pick it and they're picking pitches at like 97 that only go 55 feet. And they're just like, I'm like, that is amazing to me. So that would have thrown me off. Cause I like to go on balls in the dirt, but I think I would have, at least the first time around, I would Colorado had a lot more stolen bases when they, but I do think they would have figured it out and started to find ways to slow me down. So, but getting caught, the other thing is also high success rate. Yeah. I think that's the other thing. Like, you pick your spot and you're more likely to make it. So, but yeah, I'm glad that they've spiced it up a little bit on the bases, because it's such a great aspect of the game.
You might be being a little modest about them figuring it out. You went 34 for 36 one year. I think your efficiency is pretty good. I think you would have been all right, Doug.
Yeah, no, I was very good at picking my spots. Yeah. I was very good. And that came from a AAA manager that, like, threw me out of the stadium when I got caught one time. So I was like, okay, I got to, like, not ever get caught. So... I think I would have picked my spots.
that'll teach you for sure. You learn your lesson right there.
Yeah, he was a little extreme, to say the least.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's great. That's a lot of fun. Doug, thanks so much for this, man. Sunday Night Baseball, Starkville Podcast, DougGlanville.substack.com. It's so great to talk to you, and keep up all the great work, man.
All right. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Doug Glanville. And again, it's Mets Dodgers, Kodai Senga against Landon Knack are the probables on Sunday Night Baseball. This week, that one should be a lot of fun. The probables for this Toronto Blue Jays game this afternoon are Bowden Francis against Stephen Kolek. Kolek, 28. He's only started 3 games this year, 2.33 ERA. The big thing with him is ground ball rate.
Right.
We went through this a little bit. Randy Vasquez isn't as an extreme ground ball rate guy, but a high contact guy, a guy you can make a lot of contact with yesterday, and we saw it play out the second time through the order. Kolek is borderline top 10 in terms of contact rate in the entire league. You can get your bat to the ball, but almost 60% of the balls in play are ground balls. So right near the tippy top in terms of ground ball rate, that's like a Brandon Little last year when he was only using the sinker level ground ball rate. So it's interesting. He's had some success early this year. You understand why. High ground ball rate, kind of play pitches in a pitcher's park. But you look underneath, he had a 6.38 ERA at AAA. He had a 5.21 ERA as a reliever last year. Don't know if I'm fully buying that the stuff is good enough to survive this way when guys hit the ball so hard, even on the ground. You can string some singles together against Kolek.
That's the Blue Jays' favorite, man. That's a good sign. But yeah, you know, this is a guy who was a reliever. He transitioned back. He didn't make the rotation out of camp. There are some question marks right there. Yeah. He's done well, but, you know, not invincible by any means.
And he has 6 pitches, but none of them are great swing and miss one. The sinker's his best pitch, but the league is hitting over 400 against it because, again, it's loud contact on the ground. So we'll see. And then on the other side is Bowden Francis, who comes in with a 5.63 ERA. He is tied for the league lead with 14 home runs allowed, and probably less important today given how well they've maintained the bullpen the last couple of days, but pretty important as you look at 13 games in 13 days here. He's gotten out of the fifth inning just once in his last 5 starts. Obviously struggling with the splitter a little bit. The curveball's getting good swing and miss, but when guys can get to it, it's getting hammered. What are you looking for from Bowden today?
Honestly, length, and that is what he'll tell you as well. That's the most important thing to him. He doesn't actually care that much about strikeouts. He wants to get outs. He wants to be efficient, and in order to do that, he needs to stay around the zone but still locate his pitches. There's been a lot of middle, and I understand that this is a guy who is, you know, looking to stay in the zone, but you still need to be smart about it. You still need to make good pitches, and that is how you give your team length. That's always what he is going to look for, and so that's kind of what I look at as well.
Well, we'll see how that plays out. Neither team has faced the opposing pitcher all that much. Bowden Francis has 9 plate appearances scattered against the Padres. 3 Blue Jays have seen Kolek from last year when he was a reliever, so not much of a sample to go on there. But again, notable that it is not the Jays' A-plus lineup today, because it is a down day for Alejandro Kirk, 1 p.m. start after a night game. It is a down day for George Springer, just as a general maintenance thing. And then Anthony Santander, who came out of yesterday's game with left hip discomfort, is not in the lineup. So Barger's in the cleanup spot. Clement is in the 5 spot. You've got Lucas Clase Straw as the outfield, and Tyler Heineman's in there. So you hope to string some of those singles together. Wouldn't be a bad day to maybe be active on the base paths if you get a little bit of traffic as well. Addison Barger stole base Tuesday, which we didn't even get to talk about, by the way, and had like 50 missiles yesterday.
This game today has the potential for mess. I'm very excited about that.
Yes. It'll be Blair and Barker cleaning up that mess for you with Jay's talk post-game. We will be back, of course, at 11 a.m. tomorrow to break it down and set you up for the Rays series. Matt Joyce and Alana Rizzo will join us on the show tomorrow. Thank you to Doug Glanville for joining us today. That was a lot of fun. Doug's the best. Thanks to Amit Mann, Jake Schultz, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Yeah, enjoy the game. 1 p.m. start. Get on your couch. Don't do any work the rest of the day. Have a wonderful Thursday.